For more than three decades, Hugh Forrest served as Chief Programming Officer of South by Southwest, the Austin-based film, interactive media, and music festival. Following the sale of South by Southwest to Penske Media, Hugh has redirected his event organizing talents. His new enterprise is a consultancy that serves community-focused events, experiences, and organizations globally. Hugh joins the Plutopia podcast this time to explain his new directions and discuss lessons learned during his time at South by Southwest.
Size is very much the enemy of community, and this was something we talked about some at South by Southwest and never really made the decision, well, no, we shouldn't restrict size. And part of the decision-making process was because we had so many problems getting any kind of size to the thing, but again, it is size and scale is the enemy of productive conversations. No one goes to a conference or an event to meet 15,000 other people, 20,000 other people, 30,000 other people. You go there to meet, to make strong connections with a much smaller portion of people. So if I was, you know, if there were an infinite amount of mulligans I would take advantage of if you could do that in life, but it's certainly one of the ones would be in rethinking the growth of South by Southwest.
Hey, welcome everybody to the latest episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast. I'm John Lebkoski, and my co-host today is Wendy Grossman. Our guest is Hugh Forrest. Hugh is best known for having led the growth of South by Southwest. You've all heard of South by Southwest, right? The conference and festival. He led the growth of South by Southwest for over 35 years. And currently, he's consulting for various community-focused events and organizations globally. His website is hughforrest.com. And we are very happy to have Hugh here. I especially, because Hugh and I are pals and have been for a long time. Hey, Hugh.
Hey, John and Wendy. It is great to be here. I'm excited about the conversation ahead.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I'm really glad to see you. And first thing I want to mention is I know you're speaking September 4th at AEO, which I guess is the Association of Event Organizers. At their conference, and your subject is Experience Amplified, the New Community Paradigm. And I want to know, what is the new community paradigm, if that's not giving it away?
John, you're reading conference materials a little bit too closely, I think. I think the new community paradigm is not a whole lot different than the old community paradigm, which is that as event organizers try to bring people together, the word event it shouldn't be the word you use, because you want to try to create an experience, not an event. And I think in 2025, more so than ever before, but not necessarily all that more so, that bringing people together one place, one time, face to face, there's something still very, very magical about that. And again, all the more important in 2025 with so much stuff we do virtually, i.e. this podcast, but face to face always rules, and incredible things happen when you bring together people face to face.
Well, when you're an event coordinator or a person who's producing an event, obviously, you've got to focus a lot on the logistics, and sometimes events scale to be very large, as we know. And I just wonder how much of an impact you can have as an event producer on the successful scaling of community, given that when community scales, what it really does is it chunks into multiple communities, right? In your experience as an event producer, have you focused as much on community as you have on logistics?
That's a great question. I Very much agree with your assessment that when get-togethers, events, experiences, confabs, whatever you want to call them, scale, it is much harder to retain that sense of community, and you inevitably have a degree of fracturing, and that's a challenge. I think as a organizer of these things, logistics are certainly of paramount importance. And when things are scaling, you have to spend a lot of time thinking about the logistics of safety. That said, the rules of community or the guidelines of community, I don't want to say rules, that sounds a little bit too formal, I think still apply to larger events that they do to smaller events. I mean, you're trying to create a platform where people are comfortable learning, networking, interacting, engaging, sharing, brainstorming. And in my mind and in my experience, you do that by engaging the community, trying to engage your community year round, and trying to demonstrate that to that community that how important they are, and how important it is to get together. So again, I think that the rules for larger events are similar to the rules to smaller events. And I've often said this, and it's often said it because it's true. I tend to get more nervous when for the events that I've organized, I tend to get much more nervous when it's a smaller 10 or 15 person event than when it's a much larger event. I mean, you get more nervous that people aren't going to show up, or people aren't going to have fun, or that no one's going to talk to each other. And sometimes those things seem harder when you're the smaller you are, right?
Well, also, it is a bit, I assume it must be a bit like being a stage performer. A friend of mine who was a folk singer used to say that, if you have an audience of 3,000 people and 10% of them laugh at your joke, that's 300 people, and the laugh builds and it takes over the whole audience. But if you have an audience of 30 people and 10% of them laugh at your joke, that's three people and they get embarrassed and they stop laughing.
This is a good mathematical explanation of these problems or challenges or paranoia, shall we say.
Well, the other thing, in a 10 for 10 to 15 person event, everybody can find you and complain about things.
That is true also. That is true also.
So I think in the work that you've done, I mean, it's safe to say that you focused on community building, and you focused on innovation, or recognizing innovation and finding ways to present it. Kind of, when did that start in your mind? I mean, I know a lot about your history in producing like South by Southwest. And I'm just wondering if that was from the word go, what you were really thinking about and what you were focused on, community and innovation.
No, I don't think so. I think that my attention, interest, passion, however you want to phrase that, with community is relatively recent, meaning more so in the last decade. I certainly remember attendees of South by Southwest talking a lot about community from the very early days. And as I recall, you wrote a book about community, or were very very attuned to this concept long before I was. I mean, I think I always knew this was in the background, but it wasn't until relatively recently that this became more of a focus, more of a passion of mine. And I would say that at least a part of that passion is seen as how the seen so much of the world change into a place that doesn't impact community as aggressively or emphatically as maybe we want. or maybe we would like. One of the things that I would always see at South by Southwest, and you know, I should have gotten used to it over the years, but I never did, is that over the course of the event itself, I would go from thinking that we were an event about technology, or we were an event about music or film or food or sports or health tech or whatever, and by the end of the event, realizing no, we're an event about bringing people together, and the topic itself is kind of background. It's what happens when you bring people together in an environment that celebrates creativity, that allows people to feel safe to share. And I think that's really, really powerful, and will continue to be powerful, and all the more so as we, for various reasons, continue to push more and more into virtual and continue to give more and more importance to things that aren't made of carbon in terms of that aren't made of carbon in terms of deciding our paths, our life journey, right?
Yeah, I always thought of it as, well, I thought of South by Southwest as a festival of ideas. I didn't always think of it as that. I take it back, but I came to think of it as a festival of ideas and realized that ideas are only powerful in a community context, really. The other thing that I always recognized about communities, though, is that to some extent, communities are defined by their wars. And there can be a lot of conflict within community. How have you dealt with that in the past? Have you dealt with the inevitable conflicts that you have in a large community of people?
Probably not as well as I should, John. But I think that again, I don't mean to go too much into the log rolling, but I feel like I've heard from you before that communities are, if built right, if approached right, are pretty resilient to challenges. That it's not all going to be peaches and cream. There are going to be problems, but if you can deal with those problems or try to deal with those problems in a relatively transparent way, that the community will generally come back around to support you. I think that often at South by Southwest, we were successful in that in terms of dealing transparently. Other times, less so. But always a learning experience. I also think that you know, your wisdom there, or your thoughts there, that communities were resilient, did pretty much define a lot of our journey. That there were times where a lot of the leaders of the community, quote unquote, were not happy with the direction we were going, but these people inevitably came back in, or most of them came back in. So again, I think that one of the, you know, I'm a powerful I'm a believer in the power of community, but I'm also very cognizant that communities take a lot of work, take a lot of effort, they take a lot of managing, and they're not always those tasks are not always the most pleasant task, but they do, I think, inevitably produce the community management does produce incredible results.
Yeah, you know, I find this interesting because one of my editors on one of the British broadsheet newspapers said to me once that a staple of British journalism, when you want to cover a subculture, is you look for the split. That there's always a split to be found, and there's always a story in the split. And so this is a staple of British journalism, is this is how, and I think that's what's wrong with a lot of subculture coverage, by the way. But at the same time, you know, if you know when I was thinking about that when the Bitcoin community, such as it is, began to splinter over various technical decisions that had to be made. And what became apparent then was that the different parts of the community had come into Bitcoin with different motives. You know, one group wanted to bypass government. One group wanted, I don't know what they wanted. And you know, but so you know, it sounds to me like the communities you've had to deal with have been more made up maybe of people whose motives aligned better.
Maybe so. I think that your analysis there of that is spot on, that as communities gain more momentum, they do often fracture and splinter in a way that sometimes is positive and sometimes is less positive. And again, that is part and parcel of just the age, the maturity, the sophistication of the community. I mean, I'm thinking back, and again, John, or again, mainly because John's been a friend for so long and part of the South by Southwest community, ding, 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 for so long. But I'm thinking back to remember when we had this split in the community because there was not enough Wi-Fi at the Austin Convention Center, and Cory Doctorow, led this kind of charge, and I'm saying this with a smile on my face. It was a very important issue at the time, but it does seem quaint, 20 years later, in terms of the kinds of challenges that a community like South by Southwest or other communities are dealing with. But again, it was completely important at the time because Wi-Fi was such a valuable asset, and we were so bad at Wi-Fi then,
I think the Computers Freedom and Privacy Conference, which is where John and I met, that was in many ways a community, even though it was, you know, a conference, went through something similar. First, when the conference when I first went in 1994, there was a computer room because people weren't traveling with laptops yet. And then everybody started traveling with a laptop, and Wi-Fi came along. And then I remember one year there was a big discussion about whether the Wi-Fi should be available in the conference room because nobody was going out and talking in the halls anymore. And there was this whole argument about what was the best thing to do. And I'm sitting there going, I'm a journalist. If I don't have Wi-Fi in the conference room, I have to go out in the hall to read my email. This is not going to help me.
This makes me think about Emerging Technology Conference one year that O'Reilly used to put on. I showed up with my laptop and I somehow had forgot to bring my charger. And all I had to do was post it. There was some shared space that the conference had set up, and I posted that I didn't have a charger, and there was somebody there handed me one within an hour,
Yeah, that was when you could use
speaking of
Twitter for those
community.
things. You could use Twitter for those things. I mean, I remember I went to that conference a few times too, and I think I got in the habit of bringing to such conferences a one of those multi-way outlets, so that, you know, I always had a charger, but you might not be able to get an outlet. But if you had a multi-way thing, you could plug. You could say, "Could I plug this in, and then we can both use it?" You know.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm also thinking that one of the our transitions at South by Southwest, which needed to happen, I guess, but also look back with a sense of fondness and regret, is there, it used to be where so many of the attendees, so many of the community would just sit down in the hallway and talk to each other, and you would inevitably hear from people, well, that was the most fun I had, was in the hallway talking to people. And as the event got scaled bigger, we tried to kind of strategically figure out ways to get people out of the hallway because it was kind of clogging up traffic. But inevitably, in that movement to get people out of the hallway and get them more into formal conference rooms or other settings, you again lost some of what was seemed pretty magic at the time. So again, I think a lot of these things, they evolve for a certain way because of logistics and because there's a certain degree of knowledge, maturity, however you want to phrase that. But it doesn't mean that you that you don't regret the past. And you know, again, I hate to myth to
Mythologize.
yes, that's the word I was looking for, that everything was so much better way back when, because it wasn't necessarily so much better. But I always think that one of the real flag in the ground moments of South by Southwest in terms of being a having a community focus was those first few years where Bruce would come in and do a speech and, you know,
He
hand
did. He did
out.
them. He did them at CFP also. For a while he did the wrap up, and he was
And
mostly
hand out the mimeograph of "Come to a party at my house tonight," you know, my
Bruce Sterling
backyard.
is the master of the closing speech,
Yeah, he really
and the
is.
master of the party. I mean, those parties were great, but the last party that he had nearly decimated his house
Well,
because there were so many
that was
people by
Darwin.
then.
There
That
you
wasn't.
go on the
That wasn't the
challenge of
CFP party in
scaling.
1998, was it, John?
No. The thing here is that, you know, Bruce lived here. He had a house here, and he
I know.
would.
I went to the party there.
Okay, so he would give that talk, invite everybody to the party, and it was usually a manageable number of people. But the last time he did that, there were so many people in in his audience, and so many of them actually showed up. They drank every ounce of liquor in his house, and I don't know. I think the police came in the middle of the night, that sort of thing. It was a pretty rowdy party.
I really, really hope that wasn't the CFP crowd because, I'm very fond of CFP even in memory, and I wouldn't like to think it was us.
Well, the CFP crowd is diverse enough that you can have rowdies as well as people who are a little more sedate and better behaved. And, you know, I've never went to a party at a conference where there wasn't somebody behaving badly.
Those were the days over on his house is on Cedar, right,
It was
John?
on Cedar, yeah. And the year after that party, when he decided he couldn't do it at his house anymore, I remember South by Southwest actually created a Bruce Sterling party, and I can't remember where, but
Yeah, and I don't think it had the same impact. And probably people showed up at his house anyway, you know.
probably. I wouldn't be surprised.
Anyway.
So you had to move?
He had to, it just got too big. And we tried to, South by Southwest tried to, you know, kind of like capture the same vibe, but put it into a bar or restaurant or something. And it, you know, it was a noble effort, but it didn't have the same vibe as someone saying, you know, come to my house, come to my backyard, drink all my liquor, you know, keep my neighbors up, stick around till the police show up, all that stuff, which again,
Actually, Bruce, I would think Bruce probably invited his neighbors.
he did, I'm sure. But again, this was in the big picture, this was, I think, a real, again, just symbolism of the kind of community that South by Southwest did at its best, and other events can do it at their best when you have that degree of hospitality, warmth, authenticity, vulnerability. That's all creates an incredible experience for
The
attendees.
thing is, in the computer world generally, things were more fun. The internet itself was more fun in the 90s, really, when you had things like you could go and read suck.com every day, and you had, it wasn't all, I remember there was, I forget exactly when it was, I sort of realized that when I went online now, I went to the same sort of 5 or 10 sites every day. And I really try to avoid that. I really do try to read more, a lot more widely than that. But you get a lot of your pointers from the same places, like Twitter and, well, not Twitter anymore, but Mastodon and Blue Sky. And I try to remember to go and look at Metafilter once in a while because that's a different group of people, or Slashdot, or any of these different aggregators where people post things. But I think, at some point, you know, you sort of realize we're all using the same four or five pieces of software. We're all using the same four or five suppliers for things. You know, the world is not as much fun when it was sort of more haphazard in a way, and less.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, perhaps Bruce predicted this in a
I'm
early
sure he
speech.
did.
I'm sure he did, but I don't think we anticipated that technology, the technology revolution, information age revolution, would be so efficient at creating big winners versus everyone else. And as you're saying, Wendy, I mean, God, I hadn't thought of suck.com in ages, you
but
know?
It was fun, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And you know, I think you are correct in your assessment as well, that we have fewer choices, or we're reinforced in fewer choices to get our information now or our entertainment now. And there is that is just, in your words, not as much fun as it was before, right?
Well, I think even, you know, I mean, I get a lot of fun out of Mastodon, but you know, a lot of the internet, you sort of know that you're using a service provided by a monopolist who wants to collect your data and exploit it, and that's part of why it's not as much fun, is that there aren't some, it's harder to find amateurs now.
Yeah.
Well, and it's not shiny and new. There's a kind of grimness to it these days. And of course, the whole like political environment that we're in, the sort of darkness at the edges of things is, I mean, we're at a difficult time right now. And we think back to those days and they seem like pretty wonderful. And I guess one question is, can we get that wonder back again? You know, the thing right now is AI, and
that does not fill me with wonder.
I was about to say, I don't think people really have a sense of wonder about it. Actually, one of the interesting problems for AI and other forms of innovation and advancement is that our heads are all full of science fiction, and we've had predictions about all these things. And think of all the stories you've read about, you know, robots going nuts and trying to eliminate human beings and that sort of thing. And people sort of expect that from what they're calling AI now.
Did
you know,
did you read that blog post about creating the Torment Nexus?
No, I don't think so. What is the Torment Nexus?
Well,
I think I'm in it.
What the blog post essentially said is everybody wrote science fiction novels saying, don't create the Torment Nexus. And then along came these, you know, sort of corporate types who thought that they were like instruction manuals instead of warnings. Huh. And so they built the Torment Nexus.
But the thing is that the things that they're building now are not the same as the things that were in the science fiction books. You know, nobody's building
worse.
Robbie the robot. I mean, they may be building things that look like robots, and artificial intelligence may seem like it's an intelligence that has some like sense of itself, but it's not, you know, it's just, it's a sophisticated query response. And we're starting to think of those things as sinister because we always read that if machines became smart, they would in some way be sinister. At least that was one thread of science fiction.
Well, that wasn't Asimov's. I mean, the reason Asimov came up with the three laws is he wanted to tell stories about robots that could function with humans, you know, that could coexist with humans and that were not evil and threatening. And he had a good time writing logic puzzles, you know.
Well, I'm sure that to try to frame it in a slightly more positive way, because we're going down the path of doom, death, doom, and destruction.
Path of doom.
I'm sure there are fascinating robots out there. We just don't hear about them because so much attention or focus gets pushed on the things that are that.
All right, I have a story for you.
Fire away.
In the 1980s, a guy named Richard Greenhill went on a boat, he's a photographer, and he went on a boat to take photographs somewhere, and the boat got stranded on a sandbar for several weeks, and the only thing he had to read was the manual for a Commodore PET. And so he read this thing sort of back and forth and back and forth, and he said, you know, this thing can control anything. I could have a robot. I could build a robot. So he set out, he started buying up like odd bits of electronics at flea markets and sourcing them from the village dump and all this kind of thing. And he started kind of trying to figure out how to build a robot in this house in North London. And eventually his wife said, the ceilings are cracking from the weight of all this stuff. You'd better move it somewhere else. So he bought the house next door or something like that. And he moved all the stuff into it. And he called it the Shadow Robot Project. And when I first met him in about 1998, he had invented a sort of muscle thing, and it could sort of do things a little bit. And when I saw him again in 2008, he had this guy who had, you know, his project had attracted a bunch of oddballs by then. And one of them was this guy named Rich Walker, who had been to Cambridge and, you know, had degrees in things. And he ended up sort of turning the company pretty much over to Rich Walker. And Rich figured out that the one thing that they could make as a commercial product was a hand. And so they have a robot hand, and it can pick things up very delicately and so forth. And that hand has been bought by people like NASA and universities all over the world and all kinds of high-powered people. And I tried at some point, I think when I first met them, I tried to sell a story about him to like Discover Magazine or somebody. And they said, well, does he have degrees? I said, no, he's a classic English eccentric. He wants to build a robot. It's a great story. Well, does he have funding? No, he's a classic English eccentric. It's a great story. I got nowhere, right? Well, it's now 2025. The Shadow Robot Project is still going. They're still building these hands that are apparently the best in the world at what they in particular do. And meanwhile, they have seen off Willow Garage, Boston Dynamics. I think Boston Dynamics is still going. But there's like all these university projects that had people with degrees and had funding. And there's all these startups that had people with degrees and had funding that have come and gone in the time that this project has been out there. And they now have people who work for them who have degrees, and they're a viable business. And I just find that amazing.
So what, Wendy, what's your big picture takeaway from that? Editors have no idea what they're covering.
But I think the fact that maybe a lot of the robotics projects set up and they build something and then they disband. You know, that's how funding in neither academia nor corporate venture capital has worked well. The project that has kept going is this English eccentric who really wanted to build a robot. I don't know what the story is, but I thought it would make you happy to know that there was
in the world. I don't know. I mean, that sort of makes me think about Bill Gates. You know, Bill Gates famously doesn't have a college degree. A lot of the people who have been significant in building the tech world that we have today really didn't have that much by way of credentials, but they just had drive, you know.
Well, and they had ideas. They also had money, but they also had money behind them. Bill Gates did not grow up poor. John, do you have any way of pulling up a picture of the Shadow Robot hand?
I do. If you want to continue discussing while I look for it, let's see, Shadow Robot hand.
Yeah. It's very nice.
Oh, there it is right there.
It's very, I have seen it in person. It's very impressive. It has fingernails and things. You can pick up an egg without breaking it.
Is it the, yeah, there it is.
Yeah, the dexterous hand, I think they call it.
Hugh, I'm sure you figured that when you got here, you would be talking about robot hands.
No.
There it is. Is that it? It's a shadow robot up there.
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. Look at that.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like much until you see it.
Well, I would, Wendy, I don't know your story, or I don't know the story as well as you do, but I think that there
There he
is
is.
test. This is a testimony to the power of, as John said, people with non-technical backgrounds, people who persevere and don't take no for an answer, and people who have a, again, a strong vision for something.
On the other hand, you could say all of those things about Elizabeth Holmes. So,
Yeah, well, that too. Well,
you know,
but she had money. There you go.
I don't think I touched a computer until I was either late 30s or 40 years old, something like
No
that.
way. You didn't touch a computer until then?
Well, I may have touched one, but I didn't really use them very, like, I was skeptical about computers for a long
And were you
time.
just doing your writing on typewriters then, or in journals, or what?
Yeah, typewriters, journals, that sort of thing. Well,
Wow.
the thing is that I discovered through a job that I had, I was testing a computer application and discovered in working with these coders who were building this application, they'd look at me and they'd say, "You know, you're really, really good at this. You really get this." And I said, "Well, I'm kind of surprised, you know?" And I just got sucked deeper into it. But what really sucked me into it was community. You mentioned community earlier. It was the well. I wanted to hang out on the well and talk to people. So I had to buy my own computer, you know, and learn how to use it and go through stacks of manuals this high. It was a very rapid download of a lot of information that completely changed my life. And that was in the 80s, I think. That was probably 1985 or so.
Wow.
So, what is it? We South by Southwest Multimedia was in, the first one was in 92, was it? Or 93?
94, 94.
94. It was 94. Oh, yeah, I should know that. So in 1994, that was like 9 years after I first acquired my own computer. And by then, you know, I was kind of running with it. And I had learned an immense amount of stuff in that 9 year period.
Yeah, well, it is virtually impossible in my mind to think back to when we were non-digital, because it just doesn't compute, at least doesn't compute for me. But
Well, you had what you were publishing, what, the Austin Challenger? Was that the name of it?
that was the name of my alternative publication here in Austin.
Yeah, and
Yeah.
then you started writing for the Chronicle. And how
Yeah.
did you actually get into South by Southwest from that?
It was from the Challenger, because I had a we were a I always say we were an alternative publication, not because of our politics, but because of our publishing schedule, because we were aspired to be monthly, and we were about every other month at best. But I got at one point late in the run of the Challenger, my dad convinced me that if you start doing all your typesetting via this new thing called desktop publishing, you'll save a lot of money. And moreover, he was a prof at UT, I'll buy you the computer because you get faculty discounts. Apple was doing faculty discounts to try to convert people over. And so we bought what was then a Mac Plus and this giant laser writer. And it extended the life of the nascent Austin Challenger for half a year or more. But B, it was because I got that was my ticket to get hired at South by Southwest, because I had a computer and they didn't. And back in the early days of South by Southwest, their entire database was done on an old typesetting machine at the office in 29th Street, kind of behind fringe wearer, John. But
Oh,
old
okay.
types of
Yeah.
machines, you know, they're like giant, and it was this, you know, the floppy disk was basically something that was about 3 8-tracks put together, and was not very functional at all. But anyway, that was my entree to South by Southwest, because was because I had a computer, and that's was kind of the justification that then, Hugh, you should work on this multimedia thing. You had a computer, you know what computers are. And I'm like, oh, yeah, sure. Anyway,
And what year did you buy your first computer? Do you
that
remember?
would have been if I joined South by Southwest in 1989 because I had a computer, then I think the first year I had a computer was probably 87 or 88. I remember working on computers. The college I went to in Ohio, small college, had like a one room computer lab at that point. And I think, like all of us, you know, we all had that experience at a young age where we spent 4 hours typing something on a computer and then it
Yeah.
completely vanished. And we're like,
I am
I.
surprised to find that I had a computer before either of you. One of my friends bought a TRS-80 Model 3 in
Wow.
about 1980, and when he called me and said he'd bought it, I said, "Well, I'd like first refusal when you sell it." And because I knew him and I knew he'd be upgrading soon, and sure enough, a year later he called me and said, "Do you still want it?" So that was my first computer,
And so
but it
you use
wasn't.
that as a word processor, or?
I did. I also used it as a calendar and a bunch of other things. It was a pretty functional machine, you know. But of
Yeah.
course, it wasn't the first computer I'd ever been in contact with. That was in 1972. As a freshman at Cornell, I
Wow.
took a couple of computer science classes, and so my first computer, in a way, was an IBM 370 mainframe.
Nice.
Yeah, you know, I.
You could stick that in your backpack, right?
Well.
What?
Probably the phone in my pocket, today's phones are probably more powerful than it was. I don't
Yeah.
know.
I
But
had studied Fortran, but I never could get anything to compile.
it was programming on punch cards, you know.
Yeah. I remember those real well too. I think that I once had a gig that involved carrying like big boxes of punch cards from one building to another down at the University of Texas. So
Nice.
we have got
That was the
way off
annual
subject here.
Yeah, we
So
have. Yeah.
back to conferences. What are you working on now, Hugh? What are you going to do now?
Well, I've been lucky enough to post South by Southwest to have a number of opportunities thrown my way. The best of these opportunities all focus on this somewhat nebulous concept of community that we've talked about in this podcast, but maybe not nebulous. I mean, these are events that bring together often marginalized communities, and again, very much these events that very much believe in this power of face to face, which again, back to where we started on the recording, I think is extremely, extremely important now in terms of overcoming these divides that the information age have unfortunately inflicted upon our society. I think that you've heard this many, many times, but it is much easier, much more likely that we're civil to each other in a face-to-face conversation versus when we meet, quote unquote, online, and we don't have a we can do whatever we want, we can say whatever we want, and that often turns out to be incredibly nasty. So again, this is why I think events and community experiences and community engagement is such an important thing for humankind moving forward, and understanding that community is a big broad word that has lots of different implications, and that's fine. But again, that's what I'm exploring moving forward. Got a lot of different opportunities that kind of connect in a lot of different ways because they're kind of the same philosophies, but they're kind of all over the world, and that's a cool thing.
Do you think it's better in trying to do a sort of community-oriented event or an event as community to scale down somewhat to limit the size of it?
Yeah, I think that we talked about this earlier, that size is very much the enemy of community. And this was something we talked about some at South by Southwest, and inevitably made the decision, well, no, we shouldn't restrict size. And part of the decision-making process was because we had so many problems getting any kind of size to the thing. But again, it is size and scale is the enemy of productive conversations. No one goes to a conference or an event to meet 15,000 other people, 20,000 other people, 30,000 other people. You go there to meet, to make strong connections with a much smaller portion of people. So if I was, if there are an infinite amount of mulligans I would take advantage of if you could do that in life, but it's certainly one of the ones would be in rethinking the growth of South by Southwest and some of the decisions there to tap the brake a little stronger on some of the things we were doing that were extending our growth, but paradoxically kind of making the product harder to absorb for more people.
And you were involved in one event that I attended that online at least, that focused on AI. Are you focusing much on AI now since everybody else seems to be?
John, I'm the one person in the world who doesn't focus on AI. No, I'm one of the things I'm involved with is a startup out of New York called Andes Labs, and Andes is a made-up word that is and us, i.e., humans are a big part of this. One of the four co-founders is our mutual friend Doug Rushkoff, who's spoken many, many times at South by Southwest and is always an extremely popular speaker. Doug's kind of trademark over the last decade has been talking about team human and this idea of we've got to do more to emphasize the importance of humanity, the importance of human interaction. And that's one of the things that we are hopefully bringing to Andes Labs. I would also say that in some ways Andes is the focus here is more prosaic in the sense that the idea is that most people, as much as you can say that we've seen this script from science fiction novels, and as much as we can say that we're all in the loop of the power of AI, most of us are really ill-informed or under-informed on how best to use this technology. And in broad scopes, the best way is to use this as a one more assistant, as opposed to relying on it for to make your decisions and to be extremely critical or analytical or strategic in terms of when you give more power to the algorithms or the LLMs versus our human creativity. So that is that focus on humanity, that focus on trying to educate more people on what seems like better ways to use AI is one of the things that I like so much about this Andes Labs thing. We put together a virtual event in July, and the kind of highlight session of that kicked off the day was again our friend Doug Rushkoff talking to Brian Eno
Yeah,
about
that was great.
AI. That was pretty fascinating.
Have you had many discussions about the energy footprint of AI? There's a lot of concern about that.
Understated. Yes, there's a huge amount of concerns there. And that is, I think that's something that we need to do a better job at Andes of informing the community of those challenges. Yeah, that, for my friends and colleagues who are reluctant to get to dive more into AI, I think that's the biggest reason is that, you know, the energy impact of each query we make on AI is so significant. And if we are attuned to the global warming and climate change, how do we reconcile these two things? I'm not sure that I have I know of the solution there, but hopefully smarter minds.
I sort of tend to think that given that data centers are getting to the point where they're outstripping the grid available to them, that they're going to have to focus on finding ways to use less energy.
Absolutely.
I don't see how they're going to get around that. One of my friends who's 16 is absolutely adamant that she will not use AI because of the environmental impact. I find that interesting, you know, and she said, you know, she doesn't care what her school tells her. She just simply won't touch it.
Yeah. Well, I presume there's a not insubstantial amount of people out there that have that mindset.
Yeah.
And that's good. I mean, if we don't have that mindset, we're never going to create the kind of systems that do demand less power. So cautiously optimistic that we can find some kind of way to mitigate the environmental impact of this moving forward.
Well, we've done it before.
Yeah, we've done it before, but we were under somewhat of a different overall mindset than we are now.
Well, I was at the Computers Privacy and Data Protection Conference earlier this year in Brussels. There were a couple of speakers who talked about literally people building data centers refusing to tell the municipalities where they're building what their energy needs are going to be. How do you plan, you know?
That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of weird stuff going on. You know, one thing about AI is that you can actually use AI to find efficiencies in energy use. And we can assume that AI can be made more efficient in its use of energy. But on the other hand, we have, you know, one thing that concerns me is this this talk of ending the use of renewables in the USA, at least. We have a government now that wants to diminish the role of renewables and maybe do away with them at all if they could get away with it. I don't really understand their thinking, but much of the growth in energy production over the last decade or so has been with renewables. Especially with wind energy. And if you start like taking down wind energy projects and doing away with solar cells, then you're basically throwing away energy that we could potentially be using.
Right. Well, I mean, heartbreaking on the drill baby drill mantra and the direction of de-incentivizing all those renewable projects. I mean, I think that a more correct, prudent idea is to try to find some kind of balance here as we slowly wean ourselves off of fossil fuel, but we're not going in that direction at all. It seems like we're again accelerating.
I don't think it's going to be that easy to stop, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you can remove subsidies, but you can't actually make every municipality ban solar or ban wind or whatever. I mean, half of Wyoming is covered in wind farms, and people are using that energy. I mean, it's not going to be that easy to end that. You know, and I don't think they'll succeed.
I hope you are correct in your assessment, Wendy. I mean, I think you are correct, but it just
It is heartbreaking to watch, and you know, the complete rejection of science in general. You know, it's very hard to watch from even from outside the United States. You know, and I mean, in one sense, it's the rest of the world's benefit. It's not a benefit. It's never a benefit. But a lot of this, you know, there's going to be a lot of frustrated scientists looking for new homes.
Are already, yeah.
Yeah, I would not have put that in past tense.
and they're going to come places like here and Europe and place anywhere they can feel comfortable, you know?
Yeah.
It's a difficult time. You know, one resolution, you mentioned this earlier, is to foster communities and get people to talk to each other and get people to talk to each other with civility and sensibly. Sometimes it's hard. I think about, you know, Wendy and I are both members of The Well, and Hugh, I know you're familiar with The Well. The Well has worked as an online community now for 40 years. And I mean, imagine that, four decades as an online community, and it's still kind of ambling along. Yeah, exactly. You can compare it to Reddit, though. So Reddit is pretty popular, and it's kind of jamming along. Not the same sense of community, and it's partly because there are so many people there, and you see.
That's not how Reddit works. Reddit is hundreds of communities, or maybe even thousands of communities. You get communities in the subreddits.
I understand that, and I think that's true of The Well too. And that the what we refer to as conferences on The Well are actually sub communities. But the point is that if you're in a subreddit that has quite a bit of adoption, and many do, you'll see a post and it'll have 1,000 responses. And, you know, you can't really be part of a conversation with 1,000 other people.
Remember when Amy Bruckman came to talk to us?
Yeah, yeah.
And she is a very big Reddit user. And what she said was that the big community for her is the community of moderators of the science subreddit. Huh. So, you know, there's it's like an onion, you know, there are layers of these things.
Yeah, it's interesting. When Howard Rheingold had a system called Electric Minds, and that was moved to a different owner, and we held the community together to move it, and the people who had been hosts at Electric Minds became sort of the community. It was almost like a council. We actually tried to do a democratic thing to have a community council, and that didn't work as well. But just the hosts working together, when you have an online community, you inevitably have to have people who moderate or host conversations. And those people sort of become the government, I think, of that community. And I don't know, Hugh, maybe there's a question about whether in putting together at least larger events, large scale events, whether you need to find a way to draw from the participants to build some kind of governance structure, you know, at least part of the governance of the event could rest on their shoulders. Have you thought about trying anything like that?
Yeah, I think that is a little bit, with the emphasis on little, of what we were doing with the panel picker system, where you were essentially empowering, you know, X number of people to put together content. We were fairly hands off with those folks. So you're kind of using a distributed model there. But that doesn't quite address, I think, what you're talking about, that, you know, In more recent years, South by Southwest, as with every other, or as with most other conferences, events, experiences, has come up with a, for instance, a code of conduct that you place prominently on the website to let people know what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. And I think that is something like that is testimony that or reflects that the community does need help in terms of creating rules, and you can't simply let the community, or it doesn't work all that effectively to let the community police themselves on some of these things. And again, mind you, the code of conduct is generally addressing the worst, some of the people who are doing the least positive things in the community. But again, that happens when you get a lot of people together and mix them with alcohol and various other things. So there, I think that the discussion about Reddit is fascinating. I certainly get most of my information at this point from Reddit, but I find that I often use it in the same way that I would use a newspaper 30 years ago. It's a browsing thing to understand what the world is talking about. I also find that, similar to what Wendy was saying earlier, that depressingly, I'm tend to be, only go on four or five subreddits per day. I'll go to Austin food, a couple of sports things, but I feel like I
If you had
don't.
a local newspaper, would you read that instead? I mean, a real local newspaper that had local news as opposed to, syndicated from, some corporate
I think I
station.
would read it if it was, generally, yes. I would like it in a digital format, as opposed to newsprint. It was always my hate that, if I read a newspaper, I'd never wash my hands afterwards, because
I thought it
those.
was
Okay.
have a local newspaper. We have a pretty good local newspaper at this point, improving quite a bit since Hearst acquired it. What's it called?
The Austin American Statesman.
That's
Do you
what I
read the
thought it was.
Statesman here?
Not often. I mean, I don't get it, or I don't subscribe to it, and I had an online subscription for a while that I have not renewed. So I'll trust your perceptions and analysis that it's getting better. That's great. We certainly need more local news, and I think we need nothing against the Reddit community or other communities, but I think there is a place in our society for more professionally curated news than simply
Well,
user-based.
there are certain kinds of things that no one is going to cover unless they're paid to do it. Sending people to listen to the school board meetings and the town council meetings and investigate things that need to be investigated. You're just not going to, you have to be paid to do that kind of work. It's too because it's too it's too grueling really to do it
Well,
otherwise.
it's your assessment, I think, is correct there, but it's also, I would say that the people who have done a better job at figuring out where we are in 2025, or pushing the direction of where we are in 2025, keep going to those school board meetings and keep going to those county commissioner meetings, whereas we're home looking at Reddit. So
All
there.
politics is local.
Yeah, for
Well,
sure. We
there's a
we knew about this Statesman mainly because we had Chris Tomlinson on here recently for as one of our guests, and he's the one who told me that Hearst had bought the Statesman. I don't think I had heard about it before then. So I started, looking at it a little more closely, and you can already see the improvements.
Good. That's great.
And I hope to see, I hope to see more. I mean, the Chronicle is still here. We have a weekly, Wendy, called the Austin Chronicle. That's pretty good. I used to write for the Chronicle myself, and so did you. But you know, we have the challenge here of figuring out how to get people who are politically divided to speak to each other with some degree of civility, and that's not working out too well.
understatement there.
Yeah. Interesting thing. I mean, we're almost out of time, but I will say I was in a meeting earlier today, actually a presentation, and it was journalists. It was a Hacks Hackers thing where journalists were talking about benchmarking AI for their news organizations. And I realized in listening to that conversation, and I wasn't able to stay for the whole thing, but in listening to the conversation, the part that I caught, one thing I realized was that journalism has become increasingly sophisticated, and that they are really working hard on trying to understand how to produce accurate, correct, balanced news, you know. And they are absolutely incorporating AI, and they're working pretty hard to figure out how that works. And AI, as you said earlier, AI doesn't really work as a, it works best as a support and not as a, as the producer. It shouldn't be producing news, but it should support the production of news. Absolutely. And I was getting all that stuff from them.
I think Hacks Hackers actually started in London. And my experience of the ones I've been to anyway is that they're not, you know, there is a particular subset of journalists. The journalists who go to Hacks Hackers are the ones who are interested in using computers to do new kinds of reporting.
Right.
There's an awful lot more journalists who are not in that group.
Luddites. I'll bet there's Luddite journalists.
Well, it's not necessarily Luddites, but, you know, for example, there's a guy named Jim Watterson who started a Substack called London Centric. And he's doing basically he started it because the Evening Standard, which is London's local newspaper, decided to stop doing print and basically became a website and it wasn't doing anything. And he investigates things like why people's legs are being broken by Lyme e-bikes, or why the particular property developer who's been buying up things in the West End and ruining various community centers. And, you know, things that actually really matter to people in London, but weren't being written about and weren't being investigated. Well, that takes a lot of effort, you know, and it's not about computers. It's about, you know, going out and talking to people. And he did this shoe leather exercise of going around and talking to people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what journalism is.
John's talked about the Statesman and that improving, and that's great. I think the other thing that to mention from perspective of John and I in Austin is the Texas Tribune and what they've done, which was kind of a, you know, get a lot of funding, focus on local news and politics, covering that in a nonpartisan way, but nonetheless providing information and finding that there is a community that is very attuned to this stuff. So I don't know that a whole lot of other markets, cities, states, countries, whatever, have found success in that, in trying to replicate the Texas Tribune model. Certainly what they have done is to be admired, and one hopes that can be scaled to various other locations.
And they were pioneers in data journalism too, by the way. Sorry, yeah. Wendy, go ahead.
Was it the Texas Observer that was the one that was under threat and then it posted on Mastodon and everybody jumped up and they managed to survive?
Yeah, they raised a bunch of money all at once.
Yeah. That was a great bit of community effort.
Sure. I will say that my dad was a lifelong subscriber and supporter of the Observer. I think that their challenges, I mean, great publication, have done some phenomenal investigative reporting. That said, their challenges in terms of keeping the doors open have followed them throughout the years. I hope they're on a more stable footing now, because we certainly need much more aggressive investigative reporting in 2025. But I'm saying that the Texas Tribune model, I think, our Texas Tribune has established some really cool ideas and ways to go forward. And certainly back to this community, which has been very much the theme, I think, of this conversation, one of the things that Texas Tribune has done is create an event that brings their community together face to face.
Sort of like a well office party.
Yeah.
Bigger. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
TribFest, the Texas Tribune Festival.
Oh, maybe that's
So Hugh, let's start a newspaper.
I thought you were going to say let's start a festival.
Well, that goes without saying. Yes, we should do that. Well, our hour is actually up. We had a great conversation, and Hugh, I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
I would love to. It's been a great, very much enjoyed talking to you and Wendy about community and talking about these various different pathways.
Okay, thanks so much.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.